my guest today, who's going to be joining me for the first half of the show, DC Bureau Chief at The Intercept and contributor to The Young Turks, Ryan Grimm. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, John, how you doing?
Glad to have you on, and glad that it looks like things are working right now. You never know when a camera's going to go out, the audio is not going to broadcast the stream, or the entire thing's going to crash. So thank you for joining us. We do appreciate you you doing that. We got a lot of topics that we're going to talk about. Really fast, though, I'm curious how you're adapting to this. I mean, obviously, your job has got to look pretty different day to day with these new conditions.
Sure. You know, somebody who covers, politics, Congress, political campaigns, that's certainly throws a wrench into all of that. Congress has fled Washington, has effectively abdicated for the time being to President Trump. Campaigns are pivoting to, phone banking, digital, texting, Facebook ads, but they're still going on. But the contest there is over how and when they're going to happen, because there are still a lot of election officials who are delusional about the idea of having in-person elections, and so are dragging their feet on implementing full, kind of mail-in elections. And so, but there are still a lot of live primaries to be covering. You've got Morgan Harper taking on Joyce Beatty in Ohio. You've got a whole slew of them in New York and New Jersey, where incumbents everywhere from Josh Gottheimer to Yvette Clark, to open seats with Jose Serrano retiring, to Jerry Nadler, Carolyn Maloney, a ton of people are still getting challenged. But what does that look like? In New York, it really helps to go face to face, apartment to apartment. What does a campaign look like when you can't do that? And of course, working while you have kids who are at home who are supposed to be learning. And who don't get that idea. Like, what do you mean? I'm not in school. Why am I doing school? This makes no sense. I'm like, I hear that. But that's what we've got to try to do anyway. So, but these are historic times that we're living through. And, I have it about as good as I could hope for, or anybody could ask for, really.
Yeah, I consider myself pretty lucky too. Like, I can only imagine for the many people. We're just about to talk about unemployment, but the many people who had to pay rent and didn't have the money. Yeah. So we're gonna get to all that. Just immediately, I can see. Thank you to everybody who's already joined the stream. It's probably gonna take a bit for everyone to flood in, considering that we had to restart it twice right there. But to those of you who are there, thank you already. Feel free to like and share that stream to get more people involved in the conversation. And Ryan, I can see a lot of people who are very excited to see you on the stream. Kagutsaki says, I have his book, We've Got People, on my desk right now. It's next on my to-read list.
Well, that's good.
That's awesome.
I'm planning on doing an update to it, with the presidential primary, and Bernie Sanders is going to stay in probably so long that I can probably kind of get that out while he's even still running, depending on whether or not he decides to throw it in or kind of push it all the way to the convention, which now just got moved again deeper into August. But thank you. I'm glad you're reading it. Simpler times back when people could leave their homes. Now's a good time to get through a lot of reading.
Yeah, exactly. I've been doing a bit of rereading of some of the old classics I like. Okay, with that, well, what we've got a lot to talk about. Why don't we jump right into the news? We knew that with the record-breaking unemployment numbers reported last week that it was likely that things would not suddenly rebound come this week, but it turns out that it's even worse than a lot of people thought that it might be. The U.S. Department of Labor registered just over 6.6 million initial unemployment insurance claims for the week ending March 28th. That easily surpasses the previous record set in last Thursday's release, which in turn shattered all previous records for initial unemployment filings. And I will say, as a fan of data visualization, this has been a great moment for charts that look really crazy, like this is what you have to use to demonstrate. And that's going back to 1967. So you can see that all of these recessions, including the Great Recession of a decade ago, they barely register as blips on that in comparison to the last 2 weeks. It's
right,
crazy.
And I think we probably have a lot more coming. I think to the credit of Congress, they did something about unemployment in in the last stimulus, and they, they tacked on a slight bonus for people, because you know when you move from employed to unemployed, your unemployment check almost never, like 99.9% of the time, does not cover the income that you were making before. So there's a little bit of a bonus, but I'm sure for many, 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 many people, it is still not covering what they lost. And so you know they have huge bills that are coming due, like you said, coming due today if you pay on time, or yesterday if you pay on time, over the next few days if you're the kind of person who doesn't, which you know everybody knows, you know precisely when their rent is due based on the contract. Everybody says the first, but it's like, oh wait, what does the contract say? The seventh? Okay, mm-hmm. we're gonna get that in on the seventh. So I think you have a lot more coming. I think you could easily see that number matched again next week, or perhaps even see a higher number. People are, and it has a kind of cyclical effect that as the number rises, that there, you know, there's less money circulating, and the number of, say, you know, restaurants and retailers that were open for carry out that were hoping to hang on, you know, might by then over the next few weeks, a lot of them are going to start throwing in the towel as well.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I guess when people are saying there's estimates of, you know, 20 or 30% unemployment, that it's going to be these huge numbers. I mean, this is how you get to this, is a few more weeks
right.
of this. Right. And, you know, I mean, I'm really curious, obviously, long term, what effect this is going to have. I mean, think about, like, if this lasts a few months for some individuals, let's say that hypothetically things do go back to normal at some point, that is still going to be a huge long-term impact on people's lives. The possibility that their businesses will have shut down, they might have lost apartments. I mean, God only knows. And so we're going to be seeing sort of ripple effects from this for the rest of our lives, this massive stone thrown in the pond of the American economy. I'm curious, yep. in the short term, do you think that another set of huge numbers like this coming out, is that going to put more pressure on Congress to do even more, to perhaps not wait quite as long before passing the next set of, you know, recovery legislation?
Right. Each one of these weeks that where millions of people are filing for unemployment absolutely does put pressure on Congress to do something about this, because the way that, you know, American capitalism runs, and capitalism generally runs, is it has to run. You can't hit pause on it. You know, there are quite reasonable calls for a rent moratorium, a mortgage moratorium, but even if you do that, that's not the only thing you have to do, because then you also have to take care of whoever was on the receiving end of that payment, not out of sympathy for that landlord or that bank or whoever was collecting that check, but because those institutions owe the money to other places, maybe in the form of credit to small businesses, or maybe in the form of refinances to homeowners. It's going to knock down their mortgage payment for the month. And so when all of that stuff comes to a halt, that's how a recession turns into a depression. You know, that's what you saw in the early 1930s, that, you know, everything just came to a halt. Mm-hmm. So in order to prevent that, you just have to keep pumping money into people's pockets. Like canceling rent would be great. What would be even better is if the government just paid everybody's rent. Mm-hmm. Just pick it up. You know, we've got these next 3 months, the government says, or whatever, until people can get back out and get back to work, because not paying is great, but that can lead to the system seizing up. Better to just keep it greased and running, so that when this is all over, you have fewer of what you were talking about, which is those long-term implications, because you don't want to come out of this with so much of the economy devastated that it's just effectively just dominated by Amazon and whatever private equity barons are still left. That would be a worst case scenario.
Yeah, I mean, we had this consolidation going on already where they were crowding right. out. And like, this is like the version of that. Like, it could not be a stronger, you know, impact in the short term.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of Un*** the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
It's been just about a week since Ryan Grimm, who's on the show with me, his article in The Intercept about Time's Up and Tara Reid has been released. And we've seen since then some pickup in coverage of this story, but I would hardly say that in terms of CNN, MSNBC, New York Times, those sorts of things, it certainly doesn't seem like it's exploded. And so I'm curious for you, someone who's been working on this, what do you think about where this story is at, where it's likely to go? Is it going to have a bigger impact on the primary than it seems like at present the media is really interested in it having?
Right. We'll see. You know, as I'm sure you and some of your viewers have noticed, there's a global pandemic going on.
I did notice that, actually.
Yes. If you turn on cable, they talk about it every now and then. So, you know, certainly there is a historic news cycle going on, which, goes part of the way to explain kind of a lack of coverage. That doesn't go all the way to explain why, say, the Washington Post and New York Times haven't written articles about it. You know, in other words, there's cable. Yeah, they're going to go for what's rating. They're going to go for what's on their minds. That's coronavirus 24/7. But you know, the newspapers have different sections. They have different reporters dedicated to different beats. So it doesn't entirely explain that. Now, I think over the next week, we'll have a more conclusive answer over the question of just how much they're going to cover, because news outlets, for very legitimate reasons, are slow and careful and deliberate in general in the way that they cover allegations of these sort. A lot of people have compared it to the Christine Blasey Ford situation, but I don't think that that's entirely fair to the media for this reason. And for instance, I was the first to write about the Ford allegation, but there was a political dispute over the allegation, and that was the subject of my story. I wasn't able to investigate and kind of interrogate the allegation itself. What I could report was that Dianne Feinstein had been told about this allegation. Other members of the Senate Democratic Caucus, and particularly the Judiciary Committee, wanted to know more details about it. Mm-hmm. And there was tension between them. And so I was able to report about that tension, where you don't exactly have that right now. You don't mm-hmm. have the Biden camp split. You don't have the DNC curious about this. On the other hand, it certainly has exposed a lot of people for a willingness to believe women when the person that they're accusing happens to be a political opponent, versus the skepticism that they bring to bear when the accused is somebody that they politically support.
Yeah. So I've been reading some of the sort of response articles trying to separate fact from fiction and all that, and they point out similar to you that there's a reason that some of these investigations by Ronan and stuff take literally years. I totally get that. I don't think that that means that the media hypothetically couldn't ask Joe Biden about it, of course. Like, it's one thing to do a full article, an in-depth piece. Like, that's going to take time. We'll see if after that time it actually happens. But they could certainly ask him about it. And at the same time, as you point out, noticing like the sort of convenient stripping away of social media activity about Christine Blasey Ford from certain Biden affiliated Twitter accounts. Like, we as reasonable people can look at that and say that that says a little bit more about, you know, what they really think about believing women than perhaps they'd want to acknowledge publicly.
Yeah, and the Biden campaign, you know, has put out, you know, two comments, one from a former executive assistant and one from their spokesperson around this question. And oftentimes when a presidential campaign will comment on something, even if it's just to deny it, media that have been holding off will use that public comment as a way to get into the story. You know, then the headline will be, you know, Biden denies allegations of sexual assault, because now, you know, he's commenting on them publicly. The news outlet is not kind of endorsing or condemning them, just saying like, this is a live controversy that has risen to the level of an on the record denial from a presidential candidate. And you didn't see many outlets, you know, even bother to cover that. At the same time, you see it trending on Twitter. You see alternative media, TYT, you know, Crystal Ball's show, others in the kind of left alternative media covering it. Of course, the right wing is, you know, gleefully lapping it up, so that they can not only dunk on Joe Biden, they can dunk on the entire Me Too movement and call them all hypocrites. You know, so they love it more than anybody. So I think my guess would be, you know, if the media doesn't pick it up now, either the moment that he officially locks up the nomination or, you know, deeper into the presidential campaign, you'll see kind of the right force the media to start covering it. And Democrats might regret by then that they didn't just hash this out now, like just talk it out now, go through it, study it, and move it through the system. Perhaps it involves an apology for misunderstandings, or, you know, however politicians handle these sorts of things. But they might regret sitting on it and seeing it burst into the open, you know, months from now.
Yeah, sort of shades of 2016, like, you know, Bernie, don't talk about, you know, the speeches Hillary Clinton's given, right, or, you know, the money that she's taken. Don't bring that stuff up. And then the general election comes. Oh, wait, it's a big story. Right. No one could have seen it coming.
Yeah. How about that? Isn't that strange?
Exactly.
How that happened? Even at one point, I didn't think they would do this, but I reached out to the Clinton campaign, I think in 2015, and I even made the argument. I was like, look, your speeches are going to come out somehow or another. Just leak them to me now. It'll be terrible for you for a day, but it'll get it over with. The spokesperson said, well, let me run that up the chain. And I don't know if she ever even bothered to, but, you know, the answer came back, no, we're going to sit on these. And of course they were not going to sit on them. The WikiLeaks dumped them in October.
Everyone is wondering, if Joe Biden does end up becoming the nominee, who is he going to choose as his running mate? And not totally unrelated topic, you know, how are the different factions of the party, even hypothetically, supposed to come together after all that we've experienced? Ryan Grimm, who's on the show, you had an article a couple weeks back that you wrote with Jeremy Scahill, I believe, where you talked about, I want to read one or two quotes from your article to give people an idea. So you said at the time, to avoid a scenario in which President Donald Trump uses the pandemic to his advantage while risking the lives of millions of Americans, the Biden and Bernie Sanders campaigns could broker a split ticket of Biden-Sanders with a clear, publicly announced, historically powerful role for Elizabeth Warren, presumably Secretary of the Treasury. Now, you acknowledged right afterward that that would likely enrage many people, including, you said, the authors of the piece that quote is from. So why do you think that would potentially help? Who would actually be pleased if that were to happen? And how likely do you think it is to happen?
Well, I guess there are a couple questions that you have to ask before you decide whether or not you think this is a useful idea to proceed. One of them is, you know, how important is it to defeat Donald Trump with anybody? And so there are plenty of Democrats, as we saw through the primary, who answer that question. That's all that matters. Any carcass that you put up on that ballot, we're going to drag across the finish line just to beat Donald Trump. And if we get anything useful beyond that, then we're grateful. Then you have some who are all the way on the other end who say, no, Donald Trump is just the symptom of a disease system. If you don't cure the system, you're just going to keep getting more and worse Donald Trumps. And so unless you can put in somebody who is going to bring about a full-scale revolution to the politics of the country, like a Bernie Sanders, then forget it. You're just making the problem worse. But then, you know, within those two extremes, you have a lot of other voters who some might say, all right, look, there is no conceivable path that Bernie Sanders has at this moment to the nomination. The most likely chance he would have of being president would be to be Joe Biden's vice president. Joe Biden has made it, you know, he commented himself that he wants to have someone who's ready to govern immediately because, as he said, quote, I'm an old guy, I think was his exact quote. Like he's kind of saying the quiet part that we're all thinking out loud. On the related to that, though, who else can actually unify the party? You can't put Ocasio-Cortez as vice president. She's not old enough. Even if you use the Pete Buttigieg, you know, experience metric to say that she's, you know, ready for it. Elizabeth Warren never endorsed Bernie Sanders, does not have the credibility with a lot of Bernie Sanders' base that she would need to kind of bring the party together.
And really her coming on to serve with Biden would be seen as more reason for her to not get that credibility back, I think, amongst most of those people.
Right. It would be a self-affirming kind of thing, or self-negating kind of thing. So the only answer left is Bernie Sanders. And if he picked Bernie Sanders, it would be such a swallowing of his pride and ideology that in order to not necessarily guarantee, but almost assure himself of getting elected, that you'd have to take that seriously. Joe Biden does not want Bernie Sanders anywhere near a Joe Biden administration. So if he actually did that, it would be a signal that he was quite open to governing in a different kind of way. And, you know, if you're Bernie Sanders and you're the vice president and the president is Joe Biden and you can't kind of work your will in that administration, then, you know, you don't deserve to be there anyway. You know, Joe Biden is not the most intimidating figure at this point. You know, he can't get through a cable news interview without reading from notes. So
it's hardly LBJ.
So a vice president Sanders could be extraordinarily powerful if it was his movement that kind of powered Biden over the finish line.
So really fast, how likely do you think that is to happen?
Well, it seems close to zero at this point because he, maybe like 90 minutes after we published this piece, Biden went out on the debate stage and said that he would pick a woman as his vice president. Unless he reneges on that, then that rules Bernie Sanders out.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think there was even before he publicly sort of said that he would do that, I thought it was incredibly likely anyway.
Right.
I think a lot of people would be frustrated. Exactly.
Yeah.
But interesting thought experiment in any event. So, it's insane, but coming up on this next Tuesday, Wisconsin is still planning to have their primary, despite the fact that they are taking other measures to limit people's contact with each other. Wisconsin has ordered residents to stay at home, shuttered non-essential businesses, and banned all public and private gatherings of any number of people, but is still planning to proceed with an election on Tuesday. Now, bear in mind, every other state that was supposed to hold a presidential primary contest in late March or April has postponed their elections or switched to vote by mail. So, Benjamin, we could have a primary on Tuesday as the number of coronavirus cases and deaths is still increasing on a day-to-day basis. What do you think about the decision by Wisconsin?
I think it's consistent with what we saw in Florida, and now we see people are dying in Florida, right? I think it's highly irresponsible, but it also shows a level of desperation that the establishment has. They want to bring this to an end as quickly as possible. And that itself is a story, right? In the face of this global pandemic in which the United States is becoming the new epicenter, they are more concerned with saving their own power than they are actual policies that would help solve this pandemic. And those policies are the policies of Bernie Sanders. And again, it's not because Bernie Sanders is so great. It's that he's advocating for the right things. But instead of being more concerned about that, they're focused on how can they expedite this this process, even if it means sending people to the polls to get sick.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I guess we're supposed to be like nice and not point out the cost in human lives that this will create. But it's not even hypothetical. Like Florida, right. We know people became infected with coronavirus as a result of going to the polls. And that, like, who could possibly say that holding an election in person, having people congregate in a time when we don't want two people standing next to each other in a Starbucks, we're going to have people line up at places we're going to have senior citizen poll workers and things like that, that is going to lead to infections. It's going to lead to deaths. There's already 1,550 cases in Wisconsin. Yeah. There have been 25 deaths. Like, I don't see how you can possibly make the case as one of the officials in Wisconsin that this is the moral, the ethical, even the pragmatic thing to do when you can postpone it and still have the vote, but under safe circumstances.
Right. It's gaslighting of the highest order. And this is what we've seen across the country. You know, we knew what was happening at the beginning of March. Right. We had an idea. Let me put it in a better context. We had an idea of what was coming. But by the time we got to Super Tuesday 2, right, when Florida was voting, this is the type of rhetoric that they were using, that it's the moral thing to do. But the moral thing to do is to stay alive and not help spread a pandemic that is costing so many lives. So I just think it's a deep moral failing that's being sold to us as the moral thing to do. And I think that's the quintessential definition of gaslighting.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just a disastrous decision to make. Now, thankfully, there are some who are trying to push them in the right direction. A statement was put out from the Bernie Sanders campaign saying people should not be forced to put their lives on the line to vote, which is why 15 states are now following the advice of public health experts and delaying their elections. We urge Wisconsin to join them. He also called on states to extend early voting once the election had been pushed back and work to move entirely to vote by mail. As of right now, it seems crazy, but the Biden campaign has not put out a statement on Wisconsin. So that they're at least not encouraging people to do it like they did in the last go around of primaries, but they are not actually putting any pressure. The presumptive nominee is not putting any pressure on Wisconsin to not go ahead with this.
That's because the people who surround Joe Biden do not care, as evidenced by the fact that Super Tuesday 2, they sent people to the polls. They encouraged them. And now they're just going to be quiet about it. They're more concerned with getting power. And here's a distinct difference, right? So as this pandemic started taking root in our country, Bernie Sanders started shifting his campaign to focusing solely on the pandemic, the policies that would help us survive the pandemic, and even raising money on behalf of people for the pandemic. And what we see on the other side of the aisle is politics as usual. You see Joe Biden running a campaign as usual. He's still sending out his regular fundraising emails. He's still having these positions that go counter to what we need right now, right? He's avoiding the conversation on Medicare for All when people are literally dying. This is not hyperbole, but people have died because they did not have insurance and could not be seen. There's one young man who died at a urgent care facility because they would not see him because he didn't have insurance. And so we have one campaign that's running a campaign that's people-centered, focused on helping us survive this pandemic, and then we have Joe Biden.
Yeah, yeah, and we've got more to say about him. But before we move on, what do you think about the news broke today that the Democratic National Convention that is going to be pushed back just by a month, which still seems kind of optimistic at this point.
Yeah.
You know, I know that conversations are going on in D.C. right now about what needs to be done to prep for the possibility that we're not going to be entirely out of this, even for the general election. I know that they want funding to do vote by mail in time for the general election, but Republicans in the Senate and Donald Trump are like vigorously opposed to that. Trump even admitting that the Dems are trying to create too much voting out of this. What do you think is going to end up happening with the general election?
Yeah, I think we're going to have to vote by mail. See, what I don't think people have come to terms, at least not our political establishment. It has not come to terms that we are in a different world right now than we've ever seen. There will be no convention in what was supposed to be June. So now they're saying July. No, there's not going to be a convention in July. We'll still be feeling the impact of this virus. We'll still be trying to get it under control. I mean, for all intents and purposes, we should shelter in place until there's a vaccine. And that's like a year from now. So the establishment is not being transparent with people, both the Democratic and Republican establishment. They're trying to get away with politics as usual as much as they possibly can because it protects their power. But there are some radical changes that have to take place just for our sheer survival. And part of it is, how are we going to carry out an election in the middle of a pandemic?
Exactly. And not expect that far more people are going to die. I mean, the idea that we'll have a vaccine by then seems basically impossible. It's possible that, you know, people will have developed some level of natural resistance to it as a result of a large percentage of the population being exposed to it at that point. That seems like a worst case scenario. But they really need to get on this. I'm glad that there are some politicians like Bernie Sanders who are pushing for that. And not saying that we should start thinking about it in a few months, but that we should be putting the infrastructure in place right now. Infrastructure, by the way, which would be great even after we're no longer thinking about the coronavirus, we're way past it, you know, making sure that we enshrine actual, in reality, access to democracy, to your vote actually counting right now, that would pay dividends in future elections and help to fight back against some of the massive suppression that we have in many states that predates, you know, by a long time, the coronavirus. Like we could really kill two birds with one stone here if we take this seriously.
Right. But that would mean we're dealing with some good faith actors, right?
Yeah.
That would mean that we're dealing with a system that honestly just didn't know that there was a way we could do it better. In fact, that they thrive on the fact that they can make voting as difficult as they possibly can. And that's one of the biggest things that this coronavirus has exposed to me. Actually, it was before the coronavirus. I think it was the Michael Bloomberg issue that really exposed to me that we're surrounded by bad faith actors that understand exactly what we need to solve our problems, but they never intended on solving those problems in the first place.
Yeah, because we call them problems, but they're not problems for everyone.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right. It's their way of maintaining power.
Yeah, exactly. Joe Biden is being talked about as the presumptive nominee. He certainly does have a lead of many delegates, and things seem to be set up in a way that it's extremely unlikely that he will not be the nominee. So what will he be if he is the nominee? One thing that's been causing a lot of concern lately is measures of enthusiasm for the supporters of different candidates. So take a look at this chart. This is going to be on the left. You see among Trump supporters, the very enthusiastic group is 53%. Somewhat is 32. So that's effectively everybody. Only 14% are not at all enthusiastic. Biden has less than half the measure of very enthusiastic supporters. So 49% somewhat. And then more than a quarter who are not so or not at all enthusiastic. And I've already seen articles that are trying to reassure us that that doesn't mean anything. There's no reason to be worried about that. I wonder if those people have any memory of what happened in 2016. Because when I see those numbers, I get a little bit worried, Ben.
Yeah, yeah. People are less enthusiastic about Joe Biden than they are than they were Hillary Clinton. And I mean that really matters. So you also have to look at the level of I'm going to use my words. I don't want to say anything wrong here, but Donald Trump has very committed voters who would go to the polls to their death on behalf of their leader, right? That's enthusiasm. So you look at Joe Biden in the midst of a pandemic, people on a good day aren't excited about Joe Biden. What do you think they're going to be in the middle of the pandemic? You think any significant numbers of people are going to risk their lives to go to the polls? So Donald Trump knows this. So it's kind of a double thing, right? Donald Trump knows this. This is why he's not going to encourage voting by mail. But then also the lack of enthusiasm for Joe Biden on a sunny day. Now we're talking about the middle of a global pandemic. Joe Biden is going to lose, and I don't want him to lose. We need to get rid of Donald Trump. We have to preface it with that. Donald Trump is a unique threat to us, but no one is motivated about Joe Biden.
You know, and when you say that, like, honestly, I would include Joe Biden in that group. I'm in the middle of writing an op-ed right now with the title, Does Joe Biden Even Want to Be President? Which seems, I guess, like a crazy question because he's been running for more than a year. He's run multiple times through the course of his life. But when I watch him in his short, sporadic, sort of begrudging media appearances recently, he does not give off to me the aura of a guy who desperately wants to be in a position where he can fix the problems that America faces and that he will do anything to get there. Like, we're facing this pandemic, and he's effectively said, you know, to directly attack Trump over it, that's playing politics. You know, I want to come together. I don't want to attack the president over it. Like, this is what people are going to be deciding based on, in large part, I think.
Yeah.
And so I wonder, does he have the enthusiasm, the fight in him to actually get it done, to win in any way other than maybe squeaking by, sort of sliding past the 50% mark?
You know, I think that's a great question, because now you put it into context and I'm wondering, does he have any fight in him? What does he fight against? Because he's always fought to have bipartisanship with Republicans, who never lifted a finger to have bipartisanship back with him and Democrats, right? But the biggest thing that you've ever seen Joe Biden's advocate for was reaching across the aisles, which ultimately meant that we were moving towards the right all of the years that he's been in the Senate, which is pretty factual. So I don't think, not only does he not have the energy, right? I actually love, I don't know if you have that graphic, or the audience have seen his new graphic of him looking like he's running. They try their best to make him look like he's full of life and vigor. So it's not really just a comment and a statement in terms of him having a lack of energy because of his age and his failing health, but it's also the fact that even at his best, he never really fought for the things that we wanted for. He always fought on behalf of working with Republicans, no matter what that meant.
So I had not seen the graphic that you're talking about. I'm assuming that's it.
Like, he looks so young and vigorous. Like, he's going out to just take a little brisk run.
It's a good picture.
It's a lie. It's a huge fabrication. If you ever see him moving in real life, like, people are carrying him around by his arms and stuff. Like, and you know, I hope, all things considered, I'd be lucky to get his age at this point, right? A lot of us are going to get taken out by this virus, and I want to be old enough to have to take a fake picture of me running to convince people that I'm young and vigorous.
And, like, I know some people, like, when we joke about that, some people go, like, why are you being so unfair? Like, I want to make clear, I didn't come into this election hating Joe Biden. I don't hate Joe Biden right now, even though there's, like, a direct financial and career incentive to hate him because, you know, I'm in left alternative media. No, I don't, but I do disagree with him fundamentally, and I am extremely scared about what he would be like as a candidate because, as you said, like, I desperately think that we need an end to Donald Trump in the White House. And so I want us to get there. Like, if I felt like Biden actually was a lock for it, I would be much more comfortable. I wouldn't have, you know, like, wrinkles sprouting on a weekly basis at this point, and stress lines and all that. But I am nervous, and it's going to take more than a little bit of, like, Photoshop on his Twitter account to reassure me.
I wonder how long it took them to get that picture. Listen, I'm with you. I don't have any personal gripe with Joe Biden outside of his really bad politics and these allegations that are circling him. In terms of him as a person, other than that, like, what I say about him has nothing to do with it has everything to do with policy. And the policies that he's advocating for, or rather he's advocating against, are literally the things that we need to survive this pandemic. So if I take a second to kind of mock the fact that they really worked hard to put that picture together to make him look young and vigorous, I mean, it's really the low-hanging fruit compared to what he's advocating against.
Exactly. Yeah, and I would say that to the extent that he does really talk about policy, it is more what he opposes, mostly in Bernie Sanders, honestly. Obviously, there's a little bit in terms of what he opposes in Donald Trump, but it's less like, this is the thing I've wanted to see happen my whole life, and I have to become president to see it happen. So I'm going to become president. I'm going to do this thing. There are candidates that fit that. Bernie Sanders is a great example. I don't see that out of Joe Biden.
No, I don't think Joe Biden, and honestly, I'm with you with your original premise. I don't think he actually cares about running or winning as much as securing it away from Bernie Sanders.
So yesterday on the show, we talked about one of the promos for The View that was quite hostile to Bernie Sanders. Maybe we'll watch that a little bit later on. And so since that show, the actual interview has happened, and I want to show you a clip of Whoopi Goldberg talking to Bernie Sanders. Here she is.
You intend to stay in this race for president because you believe there is a path to victory. I want to know what that path is, because this feels a little bit like it did when you didn't come out when Hillary Clinton was clearly the person folks were going for. So can you explain why you're still in the race and what this path is that you see?
One of the reasons, but that's not quite accurate, I worked as hard as I could to for Hillary Clinton. But the reason there is
just so we're clear, you worked for Hillary, but it took you a very, very long time to hop in. And your people also, it took a very long time for them to hop in. So I'm talking about.
Okay, so there you saw Whoopi not only setting that up, and obviously, you know, there was a bit of a spin on the initial question, but then cutting him off to add on her continuing anger against him for daring to stay in, but also his base. I mean, this is going to be something that obviously inflames them for literally the rest of their lives. And as he's coming on the show to advocate mostly for Medicare for All, which this pandemic has made even more clear is needed, and a lot of people seem to be accepting that. But all she wanted to do was to just hit him with, you know, you're staying in too long, you're hurting Joe Biden, it's gonna be more likely that Trump wins re-election.
I like Whoopi Goldberg and Sister Act 1 and Sister Act 2.
Agreed. Star Trek: The Next Generation.
Yes. Oh man, Guinan. She was everything as Guinan, right?
She was.
But she is complete trash in terms of her politics and her political analysis and her disingenuousness and her bad faith engagement, all in order to protect her profit, like her wealth. I mean, there's. That argument that she just presented to Bernie Sanders was wrong, was fallacious. It was an outright lie. Bernie Sanders gave Hillary Clinton a full-throated endorsement. He gave her more of a glowing endorsement than he ever imagined he would have to. Like, I could not believe the fact that he said all those flattering things for her, and he did it. And he did it soon enough to go and do, what, some 30-odd engagements on her behalf? It would never be enough.
I think this 42. Is the whole thing. I think
42. It will never be enough for the establishment, because the establishment is not interested in us. The establishment wants to suppress the progressive movement. If you want to see what the establishment fights for, it's the fight against the progressive movement. Have you ever seen Democrats coalesce around an idea the way they coalesced around opposing Bernie Sanders?
Exactly. I mean, he drives them insane. He just does. Yeah. And his base possibly even more.
Yeah. Yeah. No, and it becomes a very personal grudge match for them, and as evidenced by what Whoopi Goldberg did in that clip that you played, right? It is a nasty, bitter. They are actually projecting onto the Bernie Bros what they engage in themselves on a regular basis.
You know, and I'm also curious, let me play for people who might have missed it, the promo, because I want your thoughts about the way they framed his advocacy for Medicare for All as well.
Bernie Sanders, answer accusations that he's politicizing the pandemic to push his Medicare for All agenda, and that staying in the race could guarantee Trump another term. He's live on The View. Next.
So, look, yesterday I said it's not just that he's politicizing coronavirus to push his agenda, but then, like, the smiling picture of Bernie, like, as if, like, look at how happy he is that he's screwing you all over. This is a show that reaches millions of people literally every day. What do you think about the way they're spinning this policy that seems like it would really help a lot of people, and that polls are showing more and more people are interested in?
So you can see it in the picture that they chose. On any other appearance, anytime someone talks about Bernie and they're not flattered, they're not flattering him, then they would use an image of him looking mean and mad and you know. But in this case, what they did was they picked a picture of him smiling like he was giddy about messing up the campaign. That's what they're trying to convey. And so the deal is that it's such a bad faith argument. We are in the middle of a global pandemic. The United States is the new epicenter. Millions of people are going to need treatment, and a lot of people won't even go seek it because they don't have health care. And so advocating on behalf of Medicare for All is literally the moral thing to do right now in this moment. But they could not frame it like that, because that would give him the advantage in this primary that's still ongoing.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I guess just to zoom out a little bit, you know, we talked about sort of the structure of the primary, how that's likely to go forward. What do you think the end result is going to be? Do you think that effectively they're going to be successful in one way or another in locking this thing up for Joe Biden? And if so, I'm curious what you think about the theories that I've seen about the possibility that he could be replaced at the convention by someone else, possibly like Andrew Cuomo. Like that.
Yeah, I think that's a reality. I think the Democratic Party has... Listen, when they coalesced around Super Tuesday, the first Super Tuesday, I was like, okay, that was actually a brilliant political move. You couldn't really do anything but take a step back and say, damn, they got us. You know, it was a good move. But since then, the world is starting to fall apart around us because of this pandemic. And like Naomi Klein said, reality is endorsing. It continues to endorse Bernie Sanders. They want to end the primary extremely quickly because the pandemic is showing how much we need the policies of Bernie Sanders. Right. And so they're really pushing as hard as they can to bring this to an end. If they get their way, I think they'll win. But then they're going to lose in the general election to Donald Trump.
But you think that in the end, it will still end up being Biden, that he's not going to either be pushed out or pull himself out over health concerns or whatever and be replaced by someone else?
Yeah. So if they do, you know, if they pull it with Andrew Cuomo, I mean, there's like we haven't even begun the vetting of Andrew Cuomo. But here's the thing, like the deal is if they pull that, then they give us a legitimate excuse to reject the candidate. When I say us, I mean progressives, leftists, because they would have stolen democracy from right underneath us. Like there would be no pretense. There would be, you know, it would just be the machinations of a party. And so it would be political folly for them to try that. But I think that they're stupid enough to try that.
Yeah, I really wonder. I mean, it seems so crazy to think back to maybe a month ago when we were still worried that somehow Bloomberg's money was going to end up with him as the nominee, and it was all hands on deck to fight against him. And now it's like, honestly, who even knows with the pandemic that we're experiencing right now? It seems insane that they would pull him out and throw someone in there like Andrew Cuomo, who says he's not running and all that. But right. I mean, I guess we can't rule out anything. When it comes to the government's preparedness for a pandemic, the question that we are now faced with is, what did the government know and when did they know it? And we know a little bit more about what they knew, thanks to the work of Ken Klippenstein of The Nation, who joins us now. Ken, welcome back to the show.
Hey, John. Good to talk to you.
Good to have you here. You had another great exclusive. You found out information about what the military knew specifically about the threat posed by coronavirus, correct?
Yeah, that's right.
So basically, what did you find in this report you were able to uncover?
What was shocking about it to me was that this report, it was a draft plan for a response to a pandemic event. It was released in 2017. And the plan was shockingly prescient in very specific ways. For example, it anticipated that the leading bio threat that they would face would be from a influenza flu type illness that it describes as being remarkably similar to COVID-19 and its precedent coronavirus. So not only did they anticipate that, they also anticipated a lot of the shortages that we're experiencing now. For example, they anticipated that there would be a shortage of face masks, a shortage of hospital beds, ventilators as well. And it just goes down the list. They had a very clear picture of not just what would happen, but also how to respond to it. And unfortunately, it doesn't look like that. These very clear sort of plans that they had set out were heeded.
Yeah, that's what was so amazing to me about the report, was that it was shockingly specific to what we're facing right now, not only in the sort of thing that would ravage our country. It wasn't, you know, an out of control Ebola or something like that, something unearthed from the thawing tundra. It was basically what we're facing. And their estimations of the number of people that would be affected seem very much in line with what we're hearing right now. I guess the issue is then, does it seem like there was just a lack of interest in it? Did the government think that they were exaggerating? Why weren't we better prepared if this and, you know, in other cases, it seems like the experts in the room, the knowledgeable people, sort of predicted what was going to happen?
Yeah, when you talk to folks in the military, as I have, there is a lot of frustration because they feel as though this is being characterized as an intelligence failure. When in reality, the intelligence was saying exactly what would happen, and what failed was that the political leadership, and you know, probably leadership at the top of the intelligence community, they weren't heeding these very clear signs. Mm-hmm. When I ask why that is, They say that there's a tendency to react to problems in government rather than exercise any sort of foresight. And that seems to be the thought of what happened here. What's interesting about this document is it stresses how important it is to have clear communication and unified, well-orchestrated public messaging to the public to get them to social distance and adopt measures that are going to protect themselves from an illness like this. And that is the exact opposite of what President Trump did. You'll recall he described aspects of this disease as a hoax. He tried to blame it on China. And then he said, this is no big deal. And then he says, we have to do social distancing. He tweets that in all caps with an exclamation point, I think. And then after that, he says, well, actually, we won't have to do social distancing for very long because we've got to open up business again. So it's just been such a muddled message that this document and the military understood was going to undermine our ability to respond to this in a way that would prevent it from spiraling out of control. And that's what happened.
Yeah. Yeah. And look, I've been incredibly critical, as many people have been, to specifically what Donald Trump didn't do over the past couple of months. And I know that he's been saying he inherited like a broken testing system, either thinking or pretending that he's been in office for a month instead of almost an entire first term. But what I found interesting was that in your article, you talk about an individual named Dennis Kaufman, former head of the Infectious Diseases Countermeasures Division at the DIA from 2014 to 2017. He says the intelligence community has warned about coronavirus for at least 5 years. So hypothetically, while it might be a bit of a dodge to say that all of the concerns over testing are just inherited from Obama, that's not to say that hypothetically the Obama administration couldn't have done more to listen to the warnings that were already there.
Yeah, 100%. And that's what folks in the military tell me, too. They're appreciative that, the public is, holding Trump to account in terms of this. But they also say that there is a general lack of support for particularly the medical intelligence side of the military. A lot of people, including me, I don't want to make fun of anyone for not knowing that there was a medical intelligence side of the intelligence community. They understandably weren't aware that, all of this, not just sort of planning and response stuff existed, but that we could fund it better. And unfortunately, policymakers have not articulated that to the public. So the sense I get is that generally there is not enough funding for the saying, ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. There was not enough funding for the prevention, and that's how we find ourselves where we are. And that's something that stretches across different administrations, although, of course, Trump is the most radical example of not funding prevention.
I'm curious. You said that you've been talking with members of the military. I've seen a few stories about, I believe it's the aircraft carrier that right now a bunch of sailors are on, and they're very worried about the spread of coronavirus there. I've seen some reports that case numbers at bases, they're receiving directive from the top to not disclose those numbers. Have you picked up on, from the people you're talking to, any concern that the potential impact on the military isn't being prioritized, or that if it does hit the military hard, that people might not even find out about it? I guess as part of sort of PR or image control, that infections or deaths among soldiers might be sort of hushed up.
Absolutely. And that's what the military folks are saying, too, because unfortunately, in my reporting, I've tried to break down this wall that exists between civilian matters and military matters, because I don't think there should be a wall. I think, they are civilians in the sense that they go home and, have families. And also they, have an effect on the politics of the country. So that's a huge frustration, because what you see in the military, as told to me from, various Marines, people in the Army, et cetera, is that rank and file, no matter what their politics are, Republican, Trump people, Democrat, whatever, they all are taking, they overwhelmingly are taking very seriously that we need more serious measures to slow this and testing, et cetera, et cetera. And what they're saying is that it's the leadership that is not heeding this. This is a dynamic you see across national security generally, is that leadership is too close to the administration and they kind of become politicized and don't take seriously things that they should, whereas the rank and file deal with it every day, so they understand and are very realistic about what these problems mean. So they are urging me, and I'm working very hard on this to try to get, reporting out to the public about what's going on in these things, because they have very few resources. For example, there was a great publication called, there was an Army publication that was shut down recently, received DOD funding under the Trump administration that was defunded. And this was a critical tool. It's called Stars and Stripes. That's what the website was called. And it explained things, not just for the military, but also in terms that the public could understand, because the military, that's a small, their ability to pressure the Congress or elected officials is going to be limited because it's just, you know, there are a lot fewer of them and they're restricted from, you know, speaking publicly. So those sorts of things are really important. And I hope that this is something that the media pivots to cover more.
Yeah, I hope so too. Thankfully, for now, those soldiers do have you, and that is certainly something.
I'm holding it down.
Yeah, and you know, to whatever extent we can help to, you know, let more people know about what you're uncovering, we're happy to do that. For people who want more details, the article is available at The Nation. It's exclusive. The military knew years ago that a coronavirus was coming, and Ken, I know I say this a lot, but great work, man.
Great to talk to you.
Always glad to have you on. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.